Notice it says at the end of the verse 44, they escaped all safe to land. God promised that they would all survive this terrible ordeal, and God honored his word. Now, this journey from Caesarea to Rome has sometimes been called Paul's fourth missionary journey, because he's going on a trip, albeit as a prisoner, on his way to the city of Rome. And as he goes on this long journey, treacherous journey, he's going to be preaching the gospel and testifying to everybody of the goodness of God. Now, we're told in verse 1 that he was given into the hand of a centurion called Julius of Augustus's band. Centurions were very trusted individuals. They were regarded very highly by the Romans. They paid them double their salary of the ordinary soldiers, and they were in charge of 100 men, of course, is where the name centurion comes from. But they were chosen because they were loyal, experienced, and prudent men. They were known not to be rash, and they entrusted 100 lives into their care of soldiers. And a Roman soldier was a very precious commodity to the Roman state, because they lived by force. They maintained this massive empire with a tiny army. So their army had to be very disciplined and very hardworking and very loyal to the Roman state. And a centurion was appointed over 100 men because of their loyalty. And there they had proven to be a trustworthy individual. Now, Roman soldiers by nature were not kind people. They were harsh, ruthless men who thought nothing of taking the life of a man or a woman or a child. And to be a centurion, you had to be tougher again, because you had to discipline the soldiers as well as use your soldiers to execute the will of the empire against those who did wrong. You had to be a tough person. You weren't a sensitive person. You wouldn't have been a person, you know, worried too much about your skin or your looks. You were just famous for being a rough, tough soldier. So Paul, when he's handed into the care of these soldiers, this is not a five-star hotel he's going into. These are not people who are there to take care of your whims and make your life comfortable. These are tough men. But yet the amazing thing is, God, in a very short time, touches the heart of this man, Julius, to become a friend of the Apostle Paul. And this man becomes a help to the Apostle Paul. So even though Paul's going on this long, treacherous, difficult journey, God brings some friends for him to fellowship with. He has the centurion who becomes a friend. And I think maybe this centurion we will meet in heaven. There also is a man called Aristarchus, who's a fellow laborer of Paul. He's on the boat. And then Luke, the writer of the book of Acts and Luke's gospel, he says he's on the boat as well. So Paul has a friend in the Roman centurion and his two fellow believers, Aristarchus and Luke, to go on this journey. And this must have been a great encouragement to Paul. A prisoner on his way to Rome. He doesn't know if he's going to survive after he gets to Rome. Will he be martyred in Rome? But he has these friends to pray with him and to encourage him and to help him. And even the centurion becomes a friend. Now, what does that tell us about Paul? That the centurion became such a friend and so loyal to him. That tells us that Paul was a person who was a likable person, doesn't it? There's nothing spiritual about being a prickly person, about being a person that other people want to keep away from. A.W. Tozer always said, there are certain people in the church you meet who have diseased personalities. I'm sure you've met some like that. It's like they have some disease. Everyone wants to keep away from them. And they're not likable. There's nothing spiritual about that. If you read the Bible, you discover Joseph was a very likable person. Wherever Joseph went, God brought people to him who were attracted to Joseph, his personality, his character. Daniel was another young man who was a very attractive person in his personality. So there's nothing to commend yourself in being a cold-hearted person, a person that other people don't warm up to or want to keep away from. There's no value in that. There's nothing spiritual about that. And the Apostle Paul, yes, he was a tough guy. Yes, he was a great theologian, a great preacher. And he was able to endure great hardship. But he had a very warm heart and a very warm way with him. And people were attracted to him, befriended him wherever he went. Of course, the devil stirs up enemies against him. We understand that as well. Because the more you're like the Lord Jesus Christ, the more you'll have the opposition. But please see this quality in him, that he's a very winsome and a very likable character. And Paul, we're told in verse 3, they go on this ship and they make their way to a place called Zidon, just up the coast there from Caesarea. It's in modern-day Lebanon. The Zidonians came from Zidon. And when he got to Zidon, the centurion, and it must have taken just a few days, was so impressed with Paul and Paul's reputation. Maybe he'd heard about what Paul was like as a prisoner at Caesarea from other Roman soldiers. He said to Paul, go and meet your friends at Zidon. There must have been some Christians who had a church there in that place. And Paul was able to go there and spend some time talking and fellowshipping, no doubt praying and encouraging the believers at that place called Zidon. And then from there, they went across the Mediterranean Sea, past Cyprus, all the way to Myra, and then this place, Cnidus or Cnidus. And they were about to head to Crete. And that's where we pick up the story in verse 9. Now, when much time was spent and when sailing was now dangerous because the fast was now also past, Paul admonished them. What's he going to tell them from Cnidus? He said unto them, sirs, I perceive that this voyage will be with hurt and much damage, not only of the lading, that's the cargo and the ship, but also of our lives. Now, where is Paul? He's here on the map. They're at Cnidus on the coast of Turkey. Now, the plan is to go from there all the way to Italy itself. That's what the sailors hope to do. And Paul says to them, no, don't go on. If you do, there'll be trouble. Now, Paul's an experienced traveler, and he knows the danger, because in the winter time, to travel along this stretch of the water of the Mediterranean is very perilous. Now, the boat that they were in, there was 275 people, so it's not a tiny boat. It's a good-sized boat, and the pictures that you see that I put in reflect the size of the boat to hold almost 300 people, plus cargo, plus food, for such a journey. But if you've ever been out on a boat, and I have been out on a boat, I mentioned earlier in the other service, my brother-in-law is a fisherman. And I always tell people, he began and he ended my fishing career in the one trip, because he took me out in a storm on the Irish Sea. And when I was about a day out in the middle of the Irish Sea, or in this boat, it seems a big boat in the harbor. It's a six-man boat. And when you're in the harbor, it looks very big and very safe and very comfortable. But when you hit the storm in the middle of the sea, I can tell you, it is anything but comfortable. And this is what you're doing. It's like being on a roller coaster. The only problem is with a roller coaster, it ends after a few minutes, doesn't it? But when you're on a roller coaster in a storm, it lasts for hours. It's like being in the worst turbulence in an airplane for about 24 hours. Just goes on, never stops. That's what it's like being in a storm. And it was so bad, the storm I was in, that you couldn't even go onto the deck or the waves would blow you away. That's how bad it was. And after 2 days being out in the storm in the Irish Sea, and you couldn't see anything, it was literally just bouncing up and down like this. We got back into the harbor, the hometown where we came from, and my brother-in-law said to me, "Would you like to come out tomorrow?" I said, no. My career is finished in the fishing boat. I will never, ever, ever get on one of these things again. And I kept to my promise. That's almost 30 years ago. And I've never gone out on one ever since. So it's a terrible thing, let me tell you. I've been in airplanes in storms. I've been in airplanes where lightning hit the airplane. It's nothing compared to being on a boat in the middle of a storm. Now, Paul is in a violent storm, an awful storm, a storm so bad it's going to smash their boat to pieces. Now, that's a real storm. And these guys who go out on these boats in the wintertime when the real heavy winds come, it takes a lot of courage. Let me tell you this, it takes a lot of courage to go out on a boat in a storm. It doesn't matter if it's a modern boat with a modern engine, to go out and face the waves, it takes a lot of courage to be a fisherman or to be a sailor. Even if you're on a large boat, it takes a lot of courage to live such a life. And there will be times where you think you're going to die. And sailors generally are very superstitious people because of this. It's a very tough life to live on a boat and to live the life of a sailor. Because when you're out there, the water's freezing. The winds are freezing. There's no way to keep warm. People forget this. They think it's romantic. You're out on the boat and it's lovely and you're throwing out the fishing rod and you don't have to do any work. The fish just comes, hits the net, you bring it back home and there's your money. What they forget is you spend many hours out in the freezing cold throwing out the nets, then bring in the fish and sort out, clean the fish, prepare the fish for market while the net's out, and then you go back to bed for a few hours, then you're up again. So it's just hours and hours, lack of sleep, jet lag, as we would say almost. It's a tough, tough life being a fisherman and a sailor. Make no mistake about it. And Paul is on this journey, and Paul's experience, he knows this is the dangerous time to travel for these boats. There's no helicopters to rescue you. If you're stuck, look at the size of that ocean there, that sea. That's a few hundred miles wide. If you find yourself stuck in the middle of a storm here, nobody can help you. You'll feel absolutely helpless. And I can tell you, I've been on the boat in the storm, and you feel absolutely helpless. I sat in that boat, and it was just going up and down. And I said, if I ever get onto dry land again, I will never go out on one of these things. That's what you feel like when you're in an awful storm. Now, Paul's advice was not listened to by the captain and the soldiers. Now, why didn't they want to stop? He advised them to either stop there or stop at Fair Havens. Sounds good, Fair Havens. Nice name, but it's not always reflects the reality of life. There's a lot of things sound nice. If you look on your map of the world, there's a big country at the top called Greenland. And if you go to Greenland, you see nothing but ice and snow. There's no green there. Might be a green tin of 7-Up or something like that. But there's no greenery. And people often give these fancy names to things that are not real. And Fairhaven sounds like a, you know, Bintan resort. Batam, nice holiday resort in Batam. It's nothing like that. And the sailors don't want to stay there, and the soldiers, because it's a tiny little place, and they don't want to spend months in this tiny little place where there's nothing to do and very little to eat. And they said they persuade the captain and the centurion to go on to Rome, to sail on. And they look at the weather. The weather looks okay. There's a gentle south wind blowing. But the Apostle Paul said, no, don't go. If we try to make it to Italy, we're going to be wiped out in the storm. Well, we're told in verse 13, and this is a lot of people think this way. When the south wind blew softly, supposing that they had obtained their purpose, loosing thence, they sailed close by Crete. There's a lot of people like this. They just gauge at the immediate circumstance and they say, it seems okay. I'll just go on. I'll take the risk. I think it might work out all right. But experience should have told them, this is a high risk strategy. This is a high risk journey. And no doubt they looked at the Apostle Paul and they said, oh, he's just a scholar. What would he know about sailing? Let's trust our own judgment. Let's go on, because we don't want to stay in this little place. We want to make money. We want to go to the big city at Rome. We want to have a party there with all the immorality and festivities that goes on in a big city at that time, a Roman city. Let's not stay in this boring place. And they're persuaded. But look at verse 14. This little word, but. Oh, what looked good on day one didn't last long. But not long after, there arose against it a tempestuous wind called Euroclide. Basically a hurricane. Absolute storm. And they're told for 3 days they fought the storm. In fact, in verse 20 it says, they saw neither sun nor stars in many days. Wow. Can you imagine? It's so dark. It's so vicious, the storm, that there's no sunlight. You can't even see the stars. That means literally the wind and the rain is just so powerful. It's like it covers you like an envelope. And you're just bouncing up and down in the storms. You can see nothing but darkness. Now, that's tough if it lasts an hour or 2 hours. But they've been in the middle of this storm for 3 days. 24 hours. 3 days. And I notice what it says at the end of verse 20. All hope that we should be saved was then taken away. It just seemed, even, and I remember these are experienced sailors. These aren't all amateurs on the trip. Some of them are, maybe their first ever time on a boat. But many of these men who are on this ship are very experienced. And they lost hope in the middle of the storm. Now I can tell you, if you're caught in a storm in a ship, you feel very hopeless. Very hopeless. And you have there's nowhere to turn. You feel like you're on this tiny thing and you're just waves both sides of you, front, backwards, and the thing's going up and down, and you can't see land. The sky's dark. And you just feel that there's no way out of this. I'll never get out of this alive. Now, remember, in those days, there's no mechanical directional advices. There's no radar. The sailors in those days are guided by the stars. That's how they plot their position as sailors. So if it's complete darkness and they can't see the sun, they can't see the stars, what's the problem? They don't know where they are. They're absolutely lost in this terrible storm. But then in verse 21, Paul speaks. It says, after long abstinence, Paul stood forth in the midst of them and said, sirs, ye should have hearkened unto me. Now, he's not saying this to annoy them, to say, huh, see, I'm right, you're wrong. He's reminding them that he was right in order to give authority to what he's about to say next, to humble them. He says, sirs, ye should have hearkened unto me and not have loosed from Crete and to have gained this harm and loss. But now I exhort you to be of good cheer, for there shall no loss of any man's life among you, but of the ship. For there stood by me this night the angel of God, whose I am and whom I serve. Can you imagine the calmness of Paul in the middle of this storm? He just stood up and he said, listen, all hope's gone from man, but I want to tell you something. I belong to a higher force than the storm. I know someone who can calm the storm. I know someone who can keep me calm in the storm. And this God that I serve, he is with me. And he has promised me that everybody will survive on this ship. The ship won't survive, but everybody will survive. Now, that takes a lot of confidence to make that statement in the middle of a storm, doesn't it? It takes a lot of courage to make such a statement. Many years ago, a man left England on a boat to go to America. Those days it was called the colonies. It wasn't the United States. His name was John Wesley. Most of you know him as the founder of the Methodist churches. John Wesley was not a Christian when he left England. He thought he was a Christian, but he wasn't a Christian. He believed that you get to heaven by praying and going to church and visiting prisoners. And he decided he would go to America because he couldn't find any peace in his heart doing good works in England. He thought, if I go to America, to the American Indian colonies, where the American Indians are, and I teach them the Bible, that I'll find peace. I'll find a sense of forgiveness. That's what he decided to do. So he got on a boat in England and took the long, treacherous journey from England to America. But in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, guess what happened? A big storm hit the ship. And it was just like this storm. It was so bad that everybody thought the ship would be shipwrecked and destroyed. And John Wesley was absolutely terrified. He was terrified, not just because of the storm, because he thought he was going to die. And he knew deep in his heart he had no peace with God. He was afraid to meet God. But to his surprise, there was a group of Christians on that ship from the middle part of Europe. They were called Moravians. Today we have a church in Singapore called the Moravian Church. I think it's up there near Armenian Street. It's an old, old church. The Moravians were some of the earliest Christians after the Reformation, around the time of the Reformation. And they were led by a man called Count von Zinzendorf, was the leader of the Moravian people. And the Moravians, they knew the gospel. They knew Jesus Christ as their Savior. And they sat at the bottom of the ship where John Wesley was sitting. Because John Wesley was a scholar. He wasn't a sailor. He wasn't out on the deck. And the ship was just going up and down. And the sailors were telling them, there's no hope, there's no hope. And Wesley was crying, pleading with God to save him. But to his surprise, the Moravians were all calm. And they just sat and sung hymns and read the scriptures. And he said he couldn't understand, John Wesley, how these people could be so peaceful and calm in the midst of this terrible storm. And he regarded himself as a scholar. He was a minister, and they were just ordinary church members from this little church community, the Moravians. And when they survived the storm and eventually found themselves in America, John Wesley was very disturbed about this. How is it that me, a minister, who supposedly knows the Bible so well, is so afraid of death and so afraid of the storm, and these people who don't have my education, who don't even have my position as a clergyman in the Church of England, the Mother Church, how is it that they're not afraid? Wesley began to search the Bible very carefully. And it was the beginning of the search that led him eventually to realize salvation is not in works, but is in Jesus Christ. And when you know Christ, then you'll find true peace in the storms of life. Now, the Apostle Paul, he's like that here. He just gets up and he's not afraid. In fact, he says to them, be of good cheer. Cheer up. Don't be afraid. We'll survive. God has promised me that we survive. And the God that I serve, he will take care of us. Now, one interesting thing from this verse 22 onwards to the end of the chapter. Paul will start this journey as a prisoner on this prison ship. At the end of verse 44, we'll discover that Paul is effectively the captain of the ship. He takes over. And he's telling everybody what to do. And everybody's following him. And God uses his testimony to speak to all these people on the ship. You know, God can use you to be a witness for him in the most unlikely of places. The very first Filipino man I ever led to the Lord, I led him to the Lord on an aeroplane from Frankfurt to Bangkok. He was sitting beside me on the plane. Strange, isn't it? Where God can use you to be a witness for Jesus Christ. On an aeroplane. I've never met him before. I've never met him since. But an aeroplane from Frankfurt to Bangkok. And you know why I was able to talk to him? The aeroplane was about to take off, and he was very frightened. And he began to talk to me. He says, "Why are you going to the Philippines?" I says, "I'm going to the Philippines on this plane." He says, "Why are you going?" I says, "I'm going to preach the gospel." "Oh," he says, "I'm a Christian." I said, "Well, why are you so afraid?" "Oh," he says, I don't like flying, and I'm afraid of death." I says, "Well, let me tell you where you can find peace." Turned out, as I talked to him, I realized very quickly he wasn't a Christian. He's just trusting in religion. He had his little cross to hold on to, superstition that he was holding on, but he had no saving faith. But thank God, by the end of the journey, he found faith in Jesus Christ. But Paul was on the ship. And then in verse 27 says, when the 14th night was come, 14, 2 weeks on this ship. Imagine, 2 weeks. Bad enough, as I said, a few hours in the storm. 2 weeks in the storm. They find themselves lost here in the middle of the Mediterranean. And after 2 weeks, they're going to end over towards the island of Malta. You'll see it on your map. And Paul says to them in verse 33, take food, take meat. This day is the 14th day that ye have tarried and continue. So these sailors were so superstitious and so afraid of the storm, of losing their lives, that they were praying to any god. They were fasting. They were no doubt trying every trick under the trade to try and find some peace and some mercy. And at the end of 14 days, Paul says, no, no, no. Eat some food, because we're about to leave the ship. Get ready for landing. And verse 35, look at the calmness of the Apostle Paul. When he had thus spoken, he took bread and gave thanks to God in presence of them all. See how calm he is? See how he even uses his own food to be a testimony, how he eats and he prays for the food and he lets them know God is with us. And I'm confident that he'll take care of us. And then it says this, when he had broken it, he began to eat. He set the example. Paul says, don't worry. And they're probably thinking, well, trust me, you don't feel like eating much in the storm when the waves are going up and down. The appetite's gone. Paul says, no, eat. And he ate first to set them the example. And then it says, verse 36, then were they all of good cheer. And they also took some meat. They all began to eat after they saw Paul's example. Then verse 38 says, when they had eaten enough, they lightened the ship and cast the wheat into the sea. Now, isn't this interesting? These are men whose wages are dependent upon the cargo. But once they know it's a choice between your money or your life, what's the choice? Your life. The cargo is not so important anymore. Throw it overboard. And sometimes we need a storm like that in our own lives to really show us what's really important. Your life is very precious. Time is very precious that you have on earth. And it's only when God puts you in a storm like that, maybe it's a health scare, maybe it's a financial scare, maybe it's some other scare, a scare at work, you might lose your job, or a recession. When God suddenly brings that little bit of turbulence into your life, suddenly people realize the things that you're holding on to so tightly are not so important after all, can be let go. Not so serious. because what's more important is the life that God has given me. You suddenly learn where your priorities are in the storm. Is that right? Now, when they first set out on this journey, if someone had tried to take 1 cent from them, those sailors would have pulled the knife out and fought you for it, wouldn't they? But the moment they're given the choice, money or your life, very quickly the interest in the money is lost, isn't it? The interest in possessions is lost. We're told the ship ran aground in a place where obviously it's shallow. These are big ships holding 300 people. And what's below the surface is much more than is above the surface. And when they go into this shallow area in the storm, the ship runs aground and the back of it begins to fall apart. We're told those who could swim, they got out first. Always good to learn to swim. If you don't know how to swim, learn how to swim, okay? I never understand these people who you say, I can't swim. It's like saying, I can't walk. Most of the world is water. You should learn how to swim, okay? Chances are you'll end up in water sometime. Learn how to swim. And these guys learned how to swim. They got out. And the ones who couldn't learn how to swim, they had to cling on to a bit of wreckage. Now, the end of verse 44 says, they got on the broken pieces and they all escaped safe to land. Now, that sounds very romantic, doesn't it? Wow, they all made it. Just pause and think about what that storm was like and that escape was like. When they arrived on the Isle of Malta, or Melita, it's called here, they must have been cold, wet, shivering. They must have been exhausted physically, fighting the waves. You know, people often go swimming in these nice swimming pools in Singapore, don't they? And they go up and down. I see them where I live. And then they go on holidays to Australia or Thailand or Sentosa they go over to. And they say, you know, I can swim here. I'm a good swimmer. What do you think happens? They can swim for 20 lengths in their swimming pool. And they try to swim against the real waves. And they discover they can't last 2 or 3 lengths. Why? Because swimming in the sea is very different from swimming in the swimming pool. You have to swim against the force of the tides, the power of the waves. And that's exhausting. And these men, including the Apostle Paul, when they got onto the island, they didn't sort of come on and go, oh, let's go for a coffee and chicken rice. They must have just mentally, physically exhausted. They must have just flopped on the shore, freezing. There's nothing romantic about it. And here's my simple point. In the midst of all of that group of men that landed on the shore were these three men, Aristarchus, Luke, and Paul. And here's my question. Did God keep them from the storm? What's the answer? No. They all got wet. They all were tired. They all had to escape in the freezing water. They all had to go 14 days in the storm, didn't they? But did God preserve them through the storm? Ah, yes. And in life, God doesn't always save us from the storms. He saves us through the storms. See the difference? Don't expect, if you serve the Lord, that God will keep you from all the difficulties and storms of life. You'll have to go through difficulties like everybody else has to go through. You know, the Apostle Paul, God didn't, you know, give him wings and send an angel down to take him out of the middle of the storm and fly all the way to Rome. Because he's a Christian, because he's an apostle. No, God made him go through the same storm as everybody else. the same difficulties, the same pain, the same fears, the same anxieties, and he had to go through the same cold waters to get to the island. And sometimes God's way of leading us is to lead us into the storm and preserving us through the storm. Why? Because God has a plan and purpose in doing that. Because when we get to the other side, everybody must look at the Apostle Paul and said, this is God's man. Look how he came through the storm. Look how he led this ship. Look at his peace and the calmness he has, the authority he has. And God used Paul's reactions and behavior and testimony in the storm to speak to 270-odd men about their salvation. Amazing, isn't it? What God can use. And you need to remember this about life. There will be times that you're in the midst of great storms of difficulties. And often when you're in that, there's a tendency to be focused on yourself and say, oh God, what are you trying to teach me? And I need this and this. And the whole view of ourselves is between God and us. And we forget that there's 275 people watching us. And part of your testimony is not just coming to church on a Sunday and singing the songs on a Sunday. It's how you live in the storms of life Monday to Friday or Monday to Saturday. And how the unsaved world sees you, how you react when these things come to your life. What's different about you? And Paul rises above the storm, doesn't he, here? And he gives us a wonderful example. And he gave all those men in that boat. These are tough men, hardened men. And God uses Paul's testimony to speak to the centurion, but to speak to the other 270-odd men in that ship, that there's a God that can take care of you in the midst of the storms of life. Now, you may never be in a physical storm like this. I hope you never are. Okay? I wouldn't wish it on your worst enemy. It's an awful thing to be shipwrecked in a storm. It's a terrible thing. It's a frightening thing. But you will be going through other storms, other difficulties, other problems that God will bring into your life. Someone once put it this way. They said, every Christian is either coming out of a storm, in the middle of a storm, or about to go into a storm. That's the Christian life. There's always an obstacle, a hurdle, a difficulty, a problem, just around the corner. That's God's plan for your life and my life. Why do we need these storms? Well, you can see in this story, it makes us very dependent on God. It destroys self, doesn't it? You see these sailors throwing all the money overboard. They suddenly realize there's something more important than silver and gold. There's a lot of things you learn in a storm as a Christian and a non-Christian. Make sure you learn the lessons that God is teaching you in the storms of life. A lot of Christians don't learn anything in their difficulties and problems. They just learn to complain more. They become bitter. I was reading someone said this. Some people run away from their problems. They try to run away from it. Other people become bitter in the problems and difficulties. But some people embrace them and learn from them and become better in the storms. Make sure whatever trial, and everybody will face trials. It doesn't matter who you are in this room. It doesn't matter what your background is. Everybody will have some health problem in their family, some financial problem, some issue in relationships that will come in and cause all kinds of turbulence from your little well-ordered life, things that you can't handle, things that your brain and your resources can't buy yourself and can't organize a way out of. And in that storm, you need to learn the lessons of remaining anchored to the Lord in the midst of the storm. You know, we like to sing that hymn, "The Anchor Holds," don't we, in the storms of life. I think the Apostle Paul would have written a hymn like that after coming through this. I think he could have sung that hymn with gusto and said, "The Lord, the anchor holds in the midst of the storm." Let us pray. Father, we thank thee for this lesson that we tend to read in a very entertaining way, almost exciting way, of this incident where they had to go through this terrible storm. And yet, Lord, it must have been terrifying for every single one. As we contemplate what they went through, we're so thankful that the Apostle Paul learned to trust in the Lord and used this opportunity as a God-given opportunity to testify that his God is greater than the storm, that his God can deliver him through the storm. And we thank thee that the end of the chapter reveals that God kept his promise, and every single one of them were delivered in the middle of the storm. We don't know what effect it had on others, but we are sure and confident that it certainly had a good effect on many of them, from the witness and testimony of thy servant Paul. Thank thee for this man who served the Lord in good times, but also in bad times, who praised the Lord not just in the days of the sunshine, but also in the days of the darkness, and how he learned to be content in every situation where God put him. Help us to learn these lessons also, for we ask these things in Jesus' precious name. Amen.